Accession number 11767, Reel 1.
Admiral Mills, Reel 1. Could you tell me what you were doing, what capacity you were working in, please, Admiral, when the declaration of war was made in September 1939?
When the declaration was finally made, I was in temporary command of a destroyer called Brazen. We had been in the local flotilla at Plymouth before, and most of the other destroyers in the flotilla had new officers appointed, but they seemed rather to have run out when they got to Brazen, and I was in temporary command of her at Dover because my captain went sick with jaundice, and we were stationed at Dover and we were escorting ferries across the channel which were taking the troops across, sometimes laying mines in areas and on general duties of the naval protection in that area.
What was your attitude and that of your brother officers towards the declaration of war?
Well, we had, of course, been ready for it and waiting for it for a long time, and we got a series of messages which came from the Admiralty about opening various envelopes which we had, which was all part of the build-up, and so we were more or less ready for it when it came, and I think really rather impatient to get on with it.
Was there any sense of dismay?
I don't think so, no. For years we had been trained that we were going to have to fight the Germans, and we were preparing to fight the Germans for years before this. And I think everyone was totally ready for it. And I mean, of course there was dismay, because that had to be a war, but there was no surprise or breakdown in morale or anything of that sort at all, no.
How much did officers at your level know about the strength of the opposition? The German Navy.
I think we knew what we'd been told over the years about the strength. There'd been, as I say, this build-up and preparation for war. We knew what ships they had. We knew about their submarines. And I think that there were very few surprises with what there was certainly at the beginning of the war.
Had you expected that hostilities would break out more or less immediately, or had you anticipated that the long period of so-called phony war might ensue?
I think that we expected almost more to happen than did in fact happen when the war finally came, because we were all keyed up and prepared for it. Not, of course, quite sure what was going to happen, but there was almost an anticlimax when so little seemed to be happening right at the outset. There were various little incidents which occurred, but not a great deal for us, not at Dover anyway, no.
Did you get any national servicemen coming to serve on Brazen?
I think we had a few, but I don't remember very many. We mobilized, you see. We had been at Dartmouth in a real peacetime role as the guardship for the regatta which was going on at Dartmouth, and we were told to sail from Dartmouth and proceed to Plymouth to mobilize, And when we arrived at Plymouth, they were surprised that we had come so quickly. We came in the middle of the night because we thought that we were required to do this at once. And they seemed surprised and said, oh, we just expected you to come round tomorrow. And anyway, we were then at Plymouth for about 48 hours, taking on the additional crew for mobilization, of course, more ammunition and stores and things. And I find it hard to remember, but I don't remember a lot of national servicemen. No. Certainly a few and some reserves. I'm not sure that we had national service in 39, but certainly there were some. We had a couple of reserve officers, and of course there were some reserve ratings as well.
What other duties do you remember the brazen doing in the last part of 1939?
Well, we were at Dover all the time I was there. I left her in the December. The war broke out in September. We got round at the end of August, and then war broke out on the 3rd of September, I think it was. And we were always at Dover, sometimes escorting ships up the East Coast, where we would meet another escort which came down from the north, perhaps halfway up, somewhere up about as far as the Wash or somewhere like that, and back to Dover. Otherwise we were patrolling in the Channel, sometimes up the Thames estuary, but it was nearly always escorting ships and on some occasions in anti-submarine patrols across the straits. We thought at the time, or it was thought at the time, that there would be U-boats trying to get out into the Atlantic through the Straits of Dover. We had some contacts in the Straits, which were rather doubtful U-boats. Our most likely one was up when we were off the Humber. We had escorted a ship up as far as the Humber, up the east coast through the night. And coming out, we had a contact, which we thought might be a U-boat, and we dropped a lot of depth charges and tracked this for some time. I've never really ascertained whether it was confirmed as a U-boat, although there were U-boats in that area, I know, from reading the records of the time.
Did you have any other contact with the enemy before you left the Brazen?
I think the nearest other contact that we had, as I say, we were forever chasing contacts in the Straits, but not many of them were confirmed. We picked up two dead German airmen in the Straits who were floating by, but I'm afraid I don't know quite what aircraft or anything they came from, but we picked these up, and this was, I suppose, our only actual contact with the enemy.
Were they in a dinghy?
No, they were floating, just bodies.
Where and when was that?
This would have been quite close to Dover, so it would have been during November 39, probably, but quite close to Dover, not far off. They were floating with the tide, beginning to decompose a bit, I mean.
What effect on you did the losses in the early part of the war, like the Royal Oak and so on, have on you when these early German successes occurred?
Well, this was considered by everybody to be the sort of thing that could happen in war. None of us had been to war before. And it was, of course, sad. But I think we, at the time, as far as I can remember now, we accepted it as one of the consequences of going to war.
What job did you take up after Brazen?
After Brazen, I went to do my long signal course, which the signal school at that time was in the barracks at Portsmouth, and I left Debrecen in the December 39 with some sorrow, really, although I'd been wanting and waiting to do a signal, of course. Good fortune which came my way of being allowed as a young lieutenant to be in temporary command of a destroyer was, of course, one's dream situation. In fact, it was why my captain wasn't there, because with his jaundice, he was so determined to be in command of his ship when the war broke out that he refused to see a naval doctor. Well, the result was that when we were on our way to the war stations, when the Admiral saw him, he took one look at him and sent for his PMO, and my captain never came back to the ship, and that was why I was left in command. So I had some mixed feelings, because I was the only one of our flotilla, as it was then called, to be fortunate enough to have a command so young. Even the other seconds in command were all lieutenant commanders, and I just happened to be the fortunate one. And so I left it with mixed feelings, but nevertheless I had been waiting to do the signal course all the time, and it was what I'd asked to do. I always wanted to be a signal officer, for the reason that I reckoned that signal officers had one of the most interesting jobs of all. You were always with the command and you knew what was going on, and the operational side was one that interested me more than the material side. And so I then went to the barracks at Portsmouth, and I stayed there for 6 months doing this signal course.
What was your opinion of the quality of the course?
Well, they were all friends of mine, of course, because we were all we were pretty well all contemporaries, all within quite a small range of age group, and we were all lieutenants, and as I say, some were cleverer than others, some had always passed top, you know, too, which I would never expect to do. I had to work quite hard to get through, but I had one great friend on the course, and we worked together a lot, and I had to do a good deal of overtime and things like that. Towards the end of the course, we did have some exams, but we didn't have all the exams, because it was foreshortened slightly, because Dunkirk came along. The whole course, I heard afterwards, there were six of us on the course, six lieutenants, and we were all offered to the signal officer at Dover to help him with the evacuation if he wanted, and he said that he would prefer not to have six brand new signal officers come, and that he could get on all right without us. So in fact we didn't do any active service job during Dunkirk, and without doing all the exams we were all told that we'd passed the signal officers, which was a great relief to all of us, because everybody didn't always. And we went off to our various appointments.
What was yours?
And my appointment was to go as the assistant to the signal officer, who was also the flag lieutenant, to the it was called, short title was ACQ, but in fact he was the admiral commanding the battlecruiser squadron, and he had his flag in the Hood, HMS Hood. And I was also known as, although I was the assistant to this senior signal officer called, as he then was, Lieutenant Commander Villiers, subsequently became an admiral, died just a few months ago. I was also the squadron wireless officer, so I used to spend a good deal of time down below listening to the Morse and trying to understand what they were all saying and organize that side of it.
What were the main problems that you had in that job?
Well, in the job, we were sitting at anchor most of the time at Scarpa Flow. We went to sea, of course, from time to time, but we sat at Scarpa Flow for a long time. And really, I suppose the main thing we were doing was training ourselves together with the other ships for whatever we might be required to do.
What was the prestige of the Hood in those days?
The Hood always had tremendous prestige, and great emotion was aroused by her wherever we had been. I had been in her before when I first went to sea in 1932 from Dartmouth, and wherever you went in the Hood, everyone had heard of the Hood. There were plenty of ships in the Navy now, which had it. Probably most people have not ever heard of, and also, of course, they are smaller, but there seemed to be something special about the Hood. When I left Dartmouth, everybody wanted to go to the Hood, and I was one of the lucky ones. And she had this great reputation. She was a good-looking ship, a handsome ship. She had a good turn of speed, and somehow everyone had always remembered if they'd served in the Hood, and it was something that was always talked about.
Did people talk in terms, as some civilians did, of the Hood being unsinkable?
Yes, I don't know that we ever actually regarded her as unsinkable, but I would say that there was, of course, tremendous... apart from grief, there was tremendous surprise and astonishment when she was finally sunk as quickly as she was, certainly.
Was it known to you about the weakness of the armour on the upper deck?
Well, that was known, but we had been brought up to know that these ships, and indeed many others of the battleships as well, had this great thickness of armour on the waterline against torpedoes and perhaps shells as well. But it was not a, as far as I remember, it was not a subject that was discussed very much or talked about.
Whilst you were at Scarpa, did the enemy launch any attacks?
Not while I was there, no, we didn't have any attacks then.
What job did you do after the battlecruiser squadron?
After leaving the Hood, which I left in January 41, which was nearly 5 months before she was finally sunk, I went on the staff of Captain D. Liverpool. There had been a Captain D. Liverpool for some months, although it was a fairly new appointment, and he was in charge of the administration of some of the escorts to the western approaches and the Atlantic area. And three Captains D were set up at Liverpool and Greenock and in Londonderry. And when he had been there a little time, he decided it was very important that he had a signal officer urgently, because the signalling between the ships needed training and organising. And so I was sent as the first signal officer on the staff of Captain D. Liverpool, as he was called. And we didn't have any operational control over the ships. That was all done directly by the Commander-in-Chief from Derby House in Liverpool. We had our offices in Bootle, and we took the ships under our wing as soon as they came back from convoy escort duty in the Atlantic. We mended them if that was necessary. We looked after their needs and their welfare, and they, of course, nearly all went on leave for most of the time when they were in harbour. And then we had to train them for whatever they were required to do. And in my case, of course, this involved training them in their communications and checking to see that their equipment worked and that they had everything they wanted, both in their complement and in their equipment. I did sometimes, because the Captain D asked me to, from time to time, go out on convoy duty with them, which in the main, in the second half of my time there, certainly necessitated meeting them, meeting the convoys coming over, taking an outgoing convoy, wherever the ships were going, in this case mostly across to America to get more supplies, of course, and meeting an incoming one approximately halfway across the Atlantic. Sometimes, in the early days, it was all the way before the... not before America declared war, because we had an arrangement with the Americans before they ever declared war for sharing the escort duties. And I did go right across once or twice, once to Halifax and once to Newfoundland with the escort. And in the second half of the time I was there, latterly, we were meeting them halfway across the Atlantic and exchanging ships, as it were, to giving up the ones we'd taken out and meeting the ones that we were bringing home. And I went, really, because the Captain D asked me to go as a kind of supernumerary to keep an eye on what they were doing. Sometimes it was a ship which was new to the duties, and it was useful to have somebody like me who knew what the form was to go. In the case of some of my other trips, I went, I think, twice with Norwegian escorts, and they were mostly the lease-lend ships which we got from America. You remember there were 50 destroyers. And some of them were manned, in the case of the Liverpool-based ships, by Norwegians. And when they first came, I was able to go with them and help them with any language problems or any other part of the operational side of it, or to do with the signals.
When you actually went on the Atlantic convoys, did their operation, did their running surprise you in any way? Did you have any criticisms?
Not really, no, because I knew how they did, having been at Liverpool and in very close touch with the headquarters there, of course, and saw the signal officer there, who was in charge of all the signals for our escorts. So I knew all that was going on in the signalling world, and the only problems arose with the actual training of the operators and the equipment, and making sure that the senior officers could have good communications with their escorts, because this was the key to the whole thing, really. If they couldn't have instant communication and control of the escorts, then they couldn't exercise their command properly, because one frequently had to change the stations or send people off on search for U-boat or send them back to try and find out why one or two ships of the convoy were lagging behind.
Did you come into contact with the enemy on any of those convoys?
Well, never on the ones I went with, never direct contact, but we were escorting a convoy once when several ships were attacked and sunk, and we picked up the survivors from one of these ships, and this was during the night, but we weren't in very close proximity when it actually had happened.
This was a submarine attack, was it?
And this was a submarine attack, yes, where a ship had been sunken. Some people had been picked up before, and this was during the night, and we came upon two people, I think it was, on this occasion. One was the master and one was the engineer officer of the ship which had been sunk. It was very calm, and they picked up a bit of wood, which I think was probably from one of their boats that they were floating on at the time. Mm-hmm. But we didn't get contact with the U-boat ourselves then.
What was the atmosphere in Liverpool, in the headquarters at Liverpool, during the period when you were there, 41, 42, about the Battle of the Atlantic and how it was going? Were people confident, or did they get depressed about the number of losses?
There were periods of both, really. Periods of obvious confidence when things were going well, and then there were periods when the Germans developed new tactics, shall we say. They started attacking on the surface by night, and one had to work out tactics against that, and there was a constant sort of up and down of confidence and success, or perhaps temporary failure when they tried something new. And there was a long-term, I suppose, sort of strand of confidence running through the headquarters all the time, I would say, really. But there were periods, of course, of depression when everything seemed to be going badly. We had some interesting contacts with the headquarters. Being at Liverpool, we perhaps knew slightly more than some of our opposite numbers who were at Greenock or Londonderry or something, because we had to get in the car and 10 minutes later we'd be in the headquarters. But I think there was a general air of confidence running right through the whole thing, with obvious periods of sadness and depression, you know, when there were heavy losses, both of merchant ships and sometimes of escorts. And the numbers of escorts did once or twice get rather low when there'd been sinking of escorts, you know, too, which made things very stretched.
So you didn't think that Hitler could starve the islands out?
Well, I think that one perhaps thought that he might get near it one time, but somehow there was a sort of British spirit about the whole thing, which thought that we would get by. You know?
Do you remember any specific convoys that stick out in your mind?
None. I couldn't pick out any particular one that I was on, because, as I say, apart from this one instance where we picked up some people from a ship that had been sunk, I didn't actually see any direct action. I suppose the convoy that stands out in my mind was one. Latterly, we were running convoys from Gibraltar as well as across the Atlantic. Some ships that had come up, say, the west coast of Africa that way. And there was the famous one when there was the famous Johnny Walker, Captain Walker, when they sank several U-boats.